I said yesterday that there are four phases often thought of in the healing process: the crisis phase, the denial phase, the processing phase, and integration. Our help or our companionship in the healing process of others can be part of any of those phases. Often people who work in emergency rooms, for instance, say that if some sort of supportive presence, supportive and informed presence, is available in the crisis phase, long-term morbidity will decrease. That's a wonderful phrase. It sort of makes my spine tingle. I don't quite understand it. But I think what they mean is that often if there isn't a supportive presence available in the crisis phase, people can begin to sort of implode or stuff their stuff under, and that over the long-term effects can increase or be harder to deal with. So that the earlier we can get close to the beginning, the initial crisis phase, the better. On the other hand, we do know that it has been part of the movements about these abuses for the last 20 years to discover that people call 20 or 30 years after the initial incident has occurred, that mysterious readiness to heal that we talked about in the last session for those of you who were here. And it means, in fact, that the healing process can be opened at any time in someone's life after an incident occurs. So both early help and help at any time along the way can be very useful in healing. Now let me just suggest to you a couple of three or four very concrete important things that can be useful for those of us who want to be companions of someone in healing to remember. I think that the first night we were together, we talked a little bit about the numbers of abuse survivors in our society and the novelty of responses to these issues and wounds in people's lives. That leads me to say that one of the first things that is very useful in opening up the healing process is to ask people if they have experienced some kind of abuse when you hear some indicator that makes you worry about it. There are long lists of symptoms or indications of the after effects of abuse that you can find in almost any article or book on these issues. But if you hear someone, if you meet someone who's anorexic, for instance, someone who has an eating disorder, someone who has a sleeping disorder, reports that they can't sleep at night, that they have lots of nightmares, that stuff is coming up that makes them worried about sleeping, it's just real, real helpful to say something calm and matter-of-fact about that. Like, you know, today we know that many people who have anorexia may have been abused in some way, and I'm wondering if that was the case with you. Simply to ask in a very matter-of-fact tone of voice, to say, you know, sometimes when people are real, real depressed, it may be because they've had some abusive experience in the past, and I'm concerned about whether that was the case with you. That's real important, partly because mentioning those things, mentioning those after effects, may be a way of calling for help. Like my acting out as a juvenile delinquent, I was calling for help. I didn't have the right vocabulary to say, I need help. And when we don't ask, when we don't reflect back, you know, is this a call for help? Is there some abuse in your life? Then we're meeting that call for help with silence.
Uh-huh. Well, what if you don't know someone very well and you just kind of suspect that they might be anorexic? This one person I have in mind is a counselor. I think she has her PhD and she tries to help people, but she looks, I mean, she's really thin. And I think, gosh, I don't know her that well and I'm a little bit afraid to say anything.
Mm-hmm. And why are you afraid to say something? Say some more. I think it's a very common reaction that many of us have, that we're afraid to say something.
Well, I guess because I've seen her take some inventory on my life, and she doesn't have kids, and I really did not like it because she didn't know the whole story. And I felt confident in what I was doing and about what I was doing. And she had told my sister about that. It's at this bakery that I have coffee. And I'm afraid to get into her life for that reason because, you know, I don't want to be taking inventory, but I want to care about her too. She's about 45. Her husband's a surgeon, and right now she's not working. I think she's kind of trying to figure out what she's doing. And I'm not even sure I want a relationship, much of a relationship with her, just for a number of reasons. But I do kind of enjoy talking to her, and I want to be kind to her.
Does someone have a suggestion about a good way to open this up or to respond? Go ahead, Art.
If you can, find somebody who is in a close relationship with her and talk with that person and say just what you said here and have that person try to help.
My husband says take her out to lunch.
Take her out to lunch?
Yeah.
And what would you say there?
Well, no, I was just making it funny. If she's anorexic, she probably doesn't like tea. See what she eats.
I go to this bakery in our neighborhood, and she eats bread. She's really into health food, you know. She had one time been real heavy, but she's into health food, and I think she was abused as a child. You just kind of pick this stuff up when you go to coffee after exercise class. She doesn't go to that exercise class, but she eats white bread with salt and pepper on it. Or just pepper, I think it's with pepper, and drinks coffee, and it's about 11 o'clock. And she eats bagels and lots of that type of food, real plain food. And that's bound to keep you on the thin side if you don't eat butter. Yeah.
Do you want to make a suggestion?
I was just going to say, I think when you were with her, and just really listen. And then I think maybe drop the bomb.
How would you do that?
Well, I've done this through listening. You just have to really listen. When you're with somebody, you just you pick up, like you said, you picked up some of this background, this abuse background. And I think if you listen hard enough, you just tend to find something that you can hone in on. You get to know the person well enough. And then I think when you... You've kind of dropped the bomb, if you will. She knows other people have found out.
Does someone want to model? Let's maybe not think about it as dropping the bomb.
Well, you know what I mean.
I think that's how it feels to us if we're scared about bringing it up. It feels like we're going to do something really violent and harmful.
Dropping the bomb to her in that.
Yes, yes.
It's her like, well, you know.
But what I'm saying is, if we're afraid of bringing it up, it may feel to us like we're dropping a bomb on the other person.
Oh.
That may be responding to our own needs, and it may not be what she would respond.
Maybe opening the door, turning on the light.
Opening the door, turning on the light. Do you want a model?
I was just wondering what she's afraid of. She says, I'm not really interested in having a relationship with this woman anyway, but it
That's
sounds
right.
like she cares about her, so dropping the bomb, quote unquote, would just be confronting her with it and saying, I'm really worried that you may be anorexic.
But does a person who is that know, do they know you're, does a person, does an anorexic know that that she's that?
I like, would you repeat a little louder what you said?
Well, what I said was that she expressed that she didn't care about having a relationship with this woman anyway, so what have you got to lose? You know?
But would you model again what you said you could say?
Well, I would you seem to care about her as a person, so in dropping that bomb, just confront her and say, I'm really worried that you may be anorexic.
Uh-huh. I'm really worried that maybe you are anorexic, and I wonder if you would like to talk about that.
Right. The thing is that she comes across as an authority on food issues. She's a psychologist or a psychiatrist herself, you know, so she comes across as this authority and has information to give other people. You know, if you have a drug problem or whatever.
So Marla, you may be worried that she's going to respond by a lot of denial or a lot of anger or a lot of... What are you worried about in the response?
I think she should be the authority. I mean, she seems
supposed to be.
Yeah, but not on herself necessarily.
That's right. Well, I see that, but it's hard to approach. It's a little bit hard to approach it.
Let me just make a couple of suggestions here, okay? Let's see how they fit. You can ask someone who's anorexic or that you suspect, you know, if they're having an eating disorder. Sometimes asking if they're having some concerns or problems with eating is a little bit better way than to use the word anorexia, because a label mm-hmm. may tend to put someone into their denial. And just if you ask, you know, if you say, I'm concerned about it and I'd like to talk about it with you, the other person may not open up with gratitude and say, oh, I'm so glad you asked me, and pour out their lives. Right? They may not say that. They may not say. They may say, it's none of your damn business.
Bingo.
And then what?
Bingo.
Well, they're going to go home and they're going to say, hey.
Yeah. Well, are they?
Well, I think they probably
may.
Well,
I have your best.
Do you want to add?
Well, I just feel like before you even get into it, you decide if you really are willing to have a relationship with someone, mm-hmm. because if you open something like that up, you need to be able to follow through, or else you're being very patronizing and judgmental. Yeah.
What does follow through mean?
It means being there for a long time. If that's a heavy
issue.
Does it
mean being a therapist if you're not a therapist?
No, but it means sticking it out with somebody, because there's nothing worse than opening a Pandora's box and then walking away.
How about if you said something like, if you hear that someone does have an eating disorder issue, say, I'm really wondering if you have somebody that you work with about this. Have you got a counselor? Mm-hmm. If you don't have one, maybe we could look for the name of somebody that could work with you. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be the therapist.
No, but you have to be willing to invest if you're actually going to open somebody up like that and you're going to challenge them like that. I think you need to be able to be there for them.
How do you get past the denial stage in somebody who needs therapy?
You don't.
You don't.
I mean, how do you help them get past it?
Do you want to say some more about your concern?
No, well, I just, anything that I've read, it says, you know, say anorexia or eating problems or anything, this person will deny that he or she has a problem. How do you get beyond that if they keep saying, I don't have a problem?
Let me just share my experience about this, right? Because there are several different ways that can happen out of this. One is, for instance, when I use the word abuse, if I say something like, we know that people who are anorexic today often have been abused in some way in the past. The word abuse is a kind of gentle word that people often identify with. I wanted to just say that to say, it's just sometimes not helpful to say, is there incest in your home? Are you a battered woman? Because those words often make people feel labeled and scared, mm-hmm. and they don't make them sort of want to open up because they're frightened. So if you use a word like abuse, it's gentle and it might elicit something. Now, it doesn't always elicit something. Sometimes people will say, hey, you know, not me. This is okay too.
If they're an adult.
If they're an adult, thank you, Laura. If they're an adult. Now, there are a couple of things about that. One is they certainly might be in a denial phase, and you don't have any control over that. It's God and that person, and the chance accident, the combination of accident grace that I was talking about the other day. Some people get to the end of their lives and die without ever having healed. And that really is tough. It's tough if you're someone who cares about them. Hard on you to watch, but you can't control it. And then you have to deal with your own need to make it better, your own need to control, your own desire to help, and you have to take that someplace else and process your own needs about that, and your own grieving and anger about that someplace else, because it will get in your way of being a companion to that person. If you're in the mode of, I want you to deal with this and you better deal with it right now, what are you doing?
Taking care of that person.
Putting your own agenda on the person.
Controlling, taking care of.
Using her for your opinion.
Re-victimizing someone.
Mm-hmm. Bernie Siegel, in his book Love, Medicine, and Miracles, likes to use the word confrontation.
Instead of confrontation?
Instead of confrontation.
That's good.
And he says, as long as we approach that person with love,
And we may be telling them something they don't want to hear. If it's done in love, it can do them no harm.
Now, if we're telling the other, the confrontation model concerns me a little, because I'm saying that the first part you're to do is to ask. It's not to tell. It's not to say, I know you're a victim of incest. But it is to ask. It's to express your own concern and to ask. And then leave the answer up to the other person. But let me also just say to you, as a sort of hopeful sign, that it is often the case that people will deny the first several times that someone asks, but that you're asking about it in a concerned and matter-of-fact, non-shaming way can make it easier for that person to disclose at a later time, when they're ready. Did you want to add?
I was going to say, the one thing I think that I found helpful is if I can come with my own I messages and be clear what I want out of it, like that I care about you, I'm angry that I see you destroying your life, you know, instead of starting the sentence out, you are.
Yeah.
And if I can clarify it before I at least start talking, to be able to put it in I terms,
good.
So it makes it a lot easier to talk and open that door. And then I don't have to, then I've done my thing that I've had to do and said what I had to say. Mm-hmm. And then it is up to them what they're going to do with it. Whether they want to come back and open and whether they want to say no, you know, your perception's wrong, or whatever. Mm-hmm. But all my own stuff first.
Good.
The other thing is they may not have been abused. I mean, right. There are all other kinds of
right.
problems, too. So
right.
they may say no, and they may really mean no.
Right. That's right. Did you want
to
add?
Yeah, I just want to say something to the lady that brought up the example. We got away from that.
Yeah.
And I think we were not really hearing her. She was saying, you know, there's a situation, and she knows this woman somewhat, and she obviously is concerned about her, and she cares for her, but she's also intimidated by this woman. Mm-hmm. This woman is a psychiatrist or a psychologist married to a surgeon, and who wouldn't be intimidated? Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to say, I think you got to follow your own feelings. You got to follow your own instinct. And she obviously knows a lot about anorexia. I mean, she probably is, in terms of knowledge, there's nothing that you could give to her that she already doesn't know. So it's not a matter of educating her. It would just be a matter of, I would think, of just being a human being with her. And that's what you can do the very best out of your concern. So just kind of listen to your instinct and just be with her. And I think that's basically really good advice for all of us in those situations, because, you know, what we're talking about is not a professional situation, but just kind of a friend to friend, and that's what a friend does best, is just care and just be with the person. Mm-hmm. And this, what we're talking about in terms of how to ask questions, is good, but that's not really the first thing. The first thing is just kind of, you know, what's going on? Mm-hmm. Would you like to talk about,
thanks,
you know, that kind of, I mean, that's what I would think.
That's good. Let's say that maybe ask them in a private place, right? I mean, on the way out of the bakery. Mm-hmm. I once was with a friend sitting in a McDonald's at right before lunch, and she was pouring out a lot of stuff, and I was getting very confused and upset, and after a while, you know, sort of got it into my power to say, what you're describing sounds real abusive to me. And she burst into tears, and I went into crisis at McDonald's at lunchtime, right? I considered this was a real big mistake that I had made. But she was ready. She didn't care if we were at McDonald's at lunchtime, and we went away afterwards to talk about it in a place where she could feel safe. And we discussed the other night some of those things about being a safe place for the other person. And I guess, let's see if we can think about what some of those ingredients are of that humanly safe space if someone does say, you know, yes, I've been binging and purging or trying to starve myself or whatever ever since my father started. I mean, now probably a response out of an abusive situation in which the disclosure is for the first time will not come out in a real clear, you know, tidy fashion. You'll be hearing other kinds of concerns, because it may take a while for someone to sort of say in so many words what they're talking about, right? But if you're there for them through all of that, that's good. But what are some of the ingredients of that humanly safe space?
somebody who won't talk, who won't spread gossip, you can feel that you can reveal your soul. And, that would be important. That's why I hesitate in this case whether this woman would respond to somebody who wasn't a close friend of hers. I mean, it depends on whether you're really close friends or just acquaintances. I think she'd clam up. I would.
But sometimes it's better to tell a problem to a stranger than a close friend.
Yeah.
Maybe it's easier.
Sometimes that's the way friendships form.
Start, right?
How do you suppose we could model for each other what it means? How would you communicate that you're not going to tell? That you're not going to blab this all over town? What do you suggest?
Be blunt. Oh, maybe you could say, I've had a similar problem, or in some way show that you are empathizing with her.
Does that communicate that you're not going to blab all over town?
No.
Laura said, be blunt. Would you like to model being blunt for us?
If you want to share, I won't tell anyone.
This would be really good.
I don't think you can be too straightforward. Mm-hmm.
I want you to know that this information will stay with me. Mm-hmm. And that I won't tell anyone else about it unless you give me permission to do that. Would that be a real clear message?
And I think, you know, even to extend that, even with children, to be able to say, if anything needs to be shared, we can share it together. I mean, I think even with kids, that needs to know that they have that confidentiality, and that, you know, there are things you need to share, that if it has to be told to somebody else, we'll share it together. I'm not going to tell for you.
Now, you raised the issue about children before. Let's just talk.
Well, I think there's a whole different rule when you're talking about kids that have been abused and when you're talking about adults. I think we are charged as adults to take care of children. Mm-hmm. And so the rules change.
Mm-hmm. Yes, with adults, you know, being real clear and straightforward about confidentiality is real important. But with minors, the rules do change because minors are under the protection of the law. And some of you are in the helping professions, right? And you may know in your individual states of origin what the law says about your responsibility to report suspected abuse of minors. Some states make you mandated reporters in some categories, and some states not. For instance, among clergy, there are something like 38 states in which clergy are exceptions to the mandated reporting rules, and 18 states I won't be able to get that.
And two don't care?
I think there are 18 states in which clergy are mandated reporters and 32 states in which they are not. But you have to know in your own state about whether or not your own occupation fits you into those rules. But if you're not a mandated reporter, you still may have a moral responsibility to report suspected abuse of minors. And let's just clarify a little bit down the line what that means. Your responsibility is about suspected abuse. It's not up to you to investigate and conclude. It's just if you get a suspicion, and if you can be as concrete and clear about the terms of your suspicions as possible, to say, on August 18th, I observed David Pellauer taking a strap with a, you know, sharp-edged buckle and hitting Michael Pellauer in the, you know, backside behind the chalet three times at 10:45 a.m.
And you're smiling.
And if you could be as concrete as that, time, place, persons, addresses, that makes the job of child protection or the police easier. You might not always be able to be that clear and clean. But it isn't up to you to sort of make a decision that there is, in fact, abuse going on there. That's someone else's responsibility. You've discharged your own responsibility. You can call the situation to the attention of the authorities. Now, if a child comes to you and says, in the course of some conversation, you know, my father is coming into my bedroom at night and touching me in way, Then you have someone right in front of you who has reported. Some of you, I bet, know more about this business about dealing with child victims and reporting than I do. You want to chime in? What is a good response to deal with your issues about reporting and care for the child there?
Mm-hmm. Well, I deal with high school age kids a lot, and I think something that was mentioned earlier, that if a child, if one of the kids comes and talks to you about something, you just have to be blunt. You have to say, you know, if you start telling me things, there are some things I have to report, but I want you to know I'll never do it alone. You know, I'll go with you to the people that we need, that we can go to, and, you know, talk. I know a person who works within the, kind of through the agency. I said, I'll take you to him. He'll know who we can talk to. You know, it's, but to just say, I'm going to tell on you, I'm going to report you, would end the conversation. But if they know, first of all, high school kids aren't going to talk to you unless there's a trust built up anyway. I mean, they won't come and say something unless they already have a comfortable relationship with you. And then you just need to reinforce that by saying, you know, we'll go together, we'll work on this together.
Do you want to?
I was going to say, I think the primary thing that we use with kids is, I'm glad that you shared this with me. This was not your fault. It's not your responsibility. There are some other people that we will need to talk with about this so we can resolve the situation and stop what's happening. That's not good for you. That's not comfortable for you. Mm-hmm. And it's not your fault.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to know, how do these things work out? You can't be general in your answer, I'm sure, but in a situation like that where the child, surely, does the mother know? Why doesn't she confront the husband? Or is this because of fear, because he's going to beat up on her? Or how do you ever resolve it? What happens to that person when he is confronted with what he's doing?
Can we just hold that 1 minute? I think that, did you want to add another thing about reporting?
I know of two situations, personally, where one where it was the father was molesting the children, his own children, and the wife, between them, they decide what to do was to report. So they reported to a Catholic agency, and he's been put in prison, and he's in prison for, I don't know how long, but he tried to get out on parole and was denied. And the other situation, one of my piano parents just told me the whole story. I didn't even seek it. The father, the two boys and the sister, the three of them, have been messing around for I don't know how many years, since the little girl was 5 or 6. And they went to some authorities, and they're all in counseling in different sections. I don't know how she happened to tell me, but just needed to talk, I guess. So there's two different ways, and this man in prison, it seems terrible to me. The family's been broken up, they've lost their home. And it was in head, she told the whole world about it. It was a headline in the Dayton paper, all about it.
Mm-hmm. Did you want
I think it's important to remember that if you are involved in some way in reporting of an abuse situation, that all state agencies, they are not allowed to reveal any information about this, and you may get bits and pieces of information or information inappropriately reported in the news media, and you may never know the follow-up of the story, and yes. So it may seem very, you may get some wrong impressions, and you may get some wrong impressions from the news media, and obviously our state agencies and Children's Protective Services do not always make the right decisions, but as a reporting individual, you will probably never know the rest of the story, and you have to assume that appropriate help was given. And try not to judge too harshly the state or private agencies that are attempting to assist families, because you simply will not know, and they will never be able to respond in the news media to misinformation. You will never see, you know, a correction, because they're bound by confidentiality, so they absolutely cannot reveal any information.
Mm-hmm. Carol?
In my first year of teaching, I ran into my first case in my classroom of a young girl that was involved in an incestuous relationship. And after, I learned a lot from that, but one of the things that I started to do, more aware of absentees, and then looking, I mean, as you notice kids that come back to look for bruises and for those kinds of things, because very often they would even kind of display those, you know. So you, and I couldn't figure that out for a while for this first one, and then I realized that she trusted me and wanted me to ask about it.
A good way to talk with a younger child, maybe to say something like, we both want this to stop, but we can't do it alone. Yeah. We need some help. And I will be with you when we talk with, if you're a friend, for instance, when we talk with child protection or counseling agencies at the school.
Good question.
Yeah, Darius, did you want to add?
Yeah. Started talking about confidentiality and how you let people open up by saying that, you know, it's just between the two of us. And then we moved from there into a different type of situation,
yes,
which says now we can tell. Now we're talking about maybe two different situations, but I question if we can really, you know, if we're misleading people by telling them that it's just between the two of us. Because we don't know what's going to be coming up. We don't know what the situation is going to be. And
between two adults?
Yeah, between two, okay, two adults. It won't get beyond this room. So then the person says, well, I beat up my kid last night. And I've been doing this on a regular basis, you know. Then all of a sudden, but then that person says, but I, you know, I'm glad you said nothing will go beyond this room. And all of a sudden you're in a real bind.
You're back to talking about kids being involved.
Yeah,
that's right. Okay, you've got to confront them and renegotiate.
Yeah. I think you're back into the anorexic business where you're going to start, okay, let's look at that. Why? I mean, why is he beating his child? Yeah. I mean, there's something there for that person. And I think in the end, listening and getting around that.
Well, my point. Let me suggest, however, that even if you're a therapist, you maybe need some specialized skills to deal with people who are violent. And that you might not want to consider, whatever your level of expertise, that you are capable of helping someone who is being violent to another person. Those people really need very specialized care. They are very often very clever. Their problems often go very deep. They are really especially good at sucking other people into colluding with their worldview. And you can get real confused real fast. I suggest that you never think that you are going to be the person who can help someone who is violent or abusive to another person.
That's not what I was saying. I was just saying you're listening and you're kind of picking, you kind of can pick up in here that there is something more involved there. Without running to the police or whatever you're going to do there. I'm not saying fix that person.
But you do, what is your responsibility to those children?
That is your responsibility.
Then, I mean, you have a little divided loyalty issue there that is not, I think, not quite resolved by listening. Mm-hmm. Because nobody's going to help those kids unless and until that is reported to the people who have the power to deal with it. You wanted to.
I think Darius brings up a really good point, and it kind of gets back to something that we left behind when we went on to talk about children. Just what is the motivation of the person who wants to be the listener or who has observed something in another that they think might reflect that they have been a victim? And I think it's really important for all of us who want to be helping people to think that through sort of before we open our mouths and say what we have formalized as perhaps these are the right words. And someone else mentioned it also. In looking personally at that relationship, am I in for the long haul and what might that mean? And therefore that's going to tell me what am I able to say to that person. Am I able to say to that person, if you tell me your secret, I'll never tell? You know, I mean, is that really being a safe place? It's like, as a Christian, how I feel about people who come door to door trying to tell me, asking me, am I saved? My feeling is, you know, you don't care about me beyond this 5-minute encounter, So, you know, I'm not interested in even responding to you. And what I'm looking for, if I want to discuss my salvation, is somebody who personally really does care about me. So it's real important, I think, for the potential listener to sort out what are you doing this for, you know? And there's even for some folks a little element of voyeurism, you know, curiosity. You know, are you really in the right spot in wanting to do this? What's your motivation?
I suppose it's dumped on you, and you didn't ask for it, and you're there.
Well, then I think you need to know and think through for yourself how, you know, do you want to say, gee, you know, this is really overwhelming for me. I would like to help you connect with somebody because I can't and don't want to take the load of that. But I think it's just real important for the person to look at, you know, I mean, queer. You want to be a helper, but that's more complicated than it looks.
I think I got a little lost or confused in the middle of what you're saying. I really affirm what you're saying about looking at our own motives. I don't know that I connect very well to motives of voyeurism.
Well, I think that's probably fairly minor, but I think it's, I don't know, I guess to me this is a real complicated topic and situation, and it's really important not to see it as being overly simplistic.
Uh-huh. Did you want to speak?
Well, I think the voyeurism part is like if there's an accident on the freeway, how many people that actually stop are really interested in helping, how many people are interested in looking? And it's the same kind of thing, you know. Do you really have the skills to stop and help, or would it be better if you just moved on to that person and everyone around you? And I think a lot of people ask, what happened? Because they just want to, kind of like a thrill, you know, and not really because they're really there to help. And that can be more devastating as far as clamming someone up than I think not saying anything at all. Because then when it's, somebody's really ready to hear it, they're more resistant to actually saying it. Because so many people have just kind of heard it and moved on, so I really can't handle it.
That happens, yes. I mean, people sometimes do see a movie about sexual abuse or whatever before they're ready, and they get into crisis, and then they, after they get out of crisis, they get clamped down, and that can happen. Did you want to add?
I just had a question. I was wondering if somebody saying, I beat my kid last night, if that is not right to help.
That's where I was coming from. Mm-hmm. But you're right, you can't get into something that's heavier. But that's exactly where I was coming from.
Darius, were you content with the sense that renegotiating is what's on the docket as appropriate? If someone then goes on to say, I'm glad you just told me this was a secret so that I could...
Two things. I don't think I would ever...
Pull you into my room?
Yeah. I would never get into the situation of strict confidentiality. But if I was, I would say, okay, I will honor that, but you're not leaving this room until we renegotiate it. You know, I said, we got to talk this one through. Because of the sake of the younger or the children or something like that. I think there's a problem here. And like the high school teacher or whatever, you're really scared. Let's not do this yourself. You know, I will walk with you. Here are some of the things. I will go along because I could tell that this is a scary experience for you and you are scared. I would be an advocate of that person and support and encourage and positive reinforce. Seeking help is the only way to go for your own self-help, let alone the child's self-help. Mm-hmm.
Did you want to speak, Art?
Yeah, and I would agree with that. And to the extent, I mean, with that loving, caring envelope around that person, I can see how, in most cases, that person is going to come through, my God, here's somebody who will really support me and help me. I know I need help. Let's go forth together. But I would say, in a black and white way that my wife gets very frustrated at, is if that person won't come around, I would violate that trust in a second to protect the child. Because if I look at the magnitude of that, the violation of a trust, something that I said here in a moment, that adult will be able to deal with in their own way and will not have too significant of an impact on them, versus the impact of the violation of the child that is not only now, but is going to go with that child through adulthood. And from generation to generation, I would violate that trust in a second, and I would feel good about that.
That is a wonderful inspirational speech, and I wish I were there. Because I would be scared. I would be frightened myself of a lot of things. And I just want to let you know that, that you know, when I grow up, maybe I would like to have Art's point of view. But not.
She's working on me.
But it's okay for you to be frightened. You know, it's okay for you to be nervous. It's okay for you to be confused and bewildered and not know what's going on and wonder what you've gotten yourself into and are you in over your head? And a few other things like that, which you will probably always feel.
Let me say. It's okay. I was almost there. Yeah. In Sunday school, I teach and taught in sixth grade class. One of the things I do with our class is we always lay down on the floor. We never sit in chairs. And I start off every Sunday school with a little bit of prayer and talking about what's been going on. And the rule of the class is anything that's discussed in the class never goes outside of the class. And what happens is over a period of the Sunday school program for the year is by the time you get about half to two-thirds way through it, the kids are really starting to trust and they're really starting to open up. And I have on two occasions encountered situations where I had a belief that there was abuse. The one that is most black and white took the information and we talked about it and we just went around the room. I responded positively. That was good. You know, what could this person do? And we got the group involved in it and went around. Then after the Sunday school was over, I went up to the minister, Greg Ains. And I said, Greg, I believe there's a situation where there's violence. And I violated that trust. You betcha I did. And Greg said, I know, I'm working with the mother. So I knew that he was working with the family that was going through divorce, and that there were resources there, and that he was better at that than I was, and I backed away from him. And to the child, I maintained that trust. But in reality, I violated it. Because if Greg wasn't aware of it, he had to become aware of it. And between Greg and I, we would talk it out and figure out, what should we do here?
Let me go back, however, to the discussion about what do you need to be prepared to commit yourself to? If you ask someone about, you know, I'm a little worried about whether or not there's abuse in your life, what do you need to be prepared for? How do we work on, you know, thinking through our own feelings up to that moment? What do people feel and think about this? David, do you want to speak?
It might be helpful to pick up, we also lost the one about the cry for help and the ambiguities.
Uh-huh.
Of thinking that way, or some
Which
of the
one?
Data here. You said it in partly, in passing, that you've got to be real careful with some of these people, that they're masters of sucking you in.
Violent people, abusive
yeah,
people. I was
right.
Not talking about survivors.
Not victims, but it came out of this one where somebody says, I beat my kids, or, you know, I do hit my wife once in a while.
Well, let me just say realistically that abusers are not very motivated to talk about abuse. And if you're feeling and thinking about this in terms of what if someone comes in and says, I beat my kids, those people are rare. Sometimes people do that, but much more likely to hear from the kids or from the spouse. Because the people who are on the hurting end of that are the ones who are motivated to get help. I mean, that's just the realism of the thing. So thinking through how do we feel and how do we prepare ourselves to ask, I would really ask you to think that it's more likely that you're talking to a survivor than to an abuser. Okay? That's the image I'd like to put in your heads. Do you want to?
I have a friend who went through, you talked really about how at transition points these things often come up in
and she had gotten married, and it all came up as they were on their honeymoon, and then she went through therapy. And I think the thing that I found in working through this process with her was that it is a long-term process, and you kind of see them. You know, you talked about the uphill climb, but the hills and valleys, and you want for that person to be healed and to be kind of through with it and moving on. And it's real hard, I think, to see your friend going through another valley. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes you're unprepared for it. You'll be working along and all of a sudden they go through other, not necessarily the same sort of a crisis. Mm-hmm. And we could talk about how these later crises points were less intense. You know, she had anxiety attacks. Originally they were very debilitating, and then later on it was just kind of anxiety or nightmares or things. And you have to be prepared for a long time to go through that with them. And you talk about getting into the stage of integration. Well, once your people are in integration, they still go back through process over and over again. And you know, she's moved to Saipan, so I don't see from her or hear from her so often, but I know that she's still going through all that.
Let me just make a suggestion here and see what you think about this. I would really encourage those of you who are concerned to help or companion someone through the healing process to think about your own needs and your own self-nurture and a way of taking care of yourself when you're working or being with someone who's in this process, because it takes a lot of energy to be there for someone who's telling a very painful story. It can take a lot of your own tears. It may make you very angry to hear some parts. It may make you despairing. It may make you real impatient. It can make you bewildered. And that those are legitimate needs that you have if you're going to be with someone in this process. And that it's real important to identify them and take care of them, preferably somewhere else. Take care of them, not in the presence. Don't ask the survivor to take care of them. Just don't say, if you hear a scary story, it's real helpful to say, sounds real scary. This makes me feel real scary. Your needs can be a source of your strength and resourcefulness in the process of listening with someone, because the feeling that you're feeling, to name it and just put it up there, may provide a name for that person, may make that person aware of what they're feeling that they're busily, you know, trying not to be in touch with. So always to be in touch with your own feelings, to validate what's going on in the conversation, but then not to ask the survivor to take care of you. That is to say, it sounds like this was a real scary experience, as a validating way, but then what I often want to do is to say, let's hurry up and talk about something else so I don't have to be scared, or, I'm so frightened about this, somehow to put myself and my own needs at the center of what's happening, instead of to constantly remember that this is this other person's story and process, and to hold them in the center of what's going on, and to be in touch with your own needs, but not to hog the floor or turn the subject of the conversation into you. But then to go away later on and say, oh, that was the scariest thing I have ever been through. I do not want to be alone in my room with the lights off, so I'll turn them on, you know? Or to say, I don't want to walk alone down that street where she talked about that story. Will you walk, asking someone if they would walk with you? So that you are getting what you need yourself to replenish your own resourcefulness so that you can be there again. Does that make sense? And I would like to ask you to think about that, taking care of yourself, and at the same time to balance it about
at what point taking care of yourself turns into denial? Are there times in which we really don't want to open up this can of worms because it would be too much for us, and that by participating in that, we're participating in society's larger denial? Or the victim's denial? And that, I think, is a very sometimes tricky thing to negotiate, and it's your own intuition that you need to rely on there.
I just wanted to say that somebody said, I think it was you, that this is real heavy stuff. And it is, and I'm a little uncomfortable because, everybody does not have to be a therapist in order to be a companion with people, but some of the stuff we've been talking about is the kind of stuff that therapists do in terms of drawing things out from people. And I feel, as a friend, being a therapist puts a person in a different position. There is protection that comes along with being a therapist because you know you're going to see this person once a week or twice a week or whatever in a somewhat controlled situation, whereas a friend is kind of always on the front line. And I have walked through with friends some really hard stuff, and it's really, really draining. And I just want to say that my feeling is that, again, I think that people, first of all, I think you only do this if you really care about somebody. And I think that the trust, you don't have to, the trust builds out of the relationship, that you're only a companion through someone's healing process. If there is a relationship, it isn't done in a casual way at all. And I agree that there is sometimes an element of voyeurism if it's a casual relationship, because you don't have any business really hearing about some really ghastly stuff that happens. So first of all, I think it's in a relationship, and there has to be a commitment in that relationship, as somebody said. And in that relationship, the trust kind of grows. The way the person comes to trust you is because they find you are trustworthy. Mm-hmm. They tell you a little bit, and then they don't hear it around town. And then they tell you a little bit more, and they discover that, lo and behold, you are not repeating this stuff, and that's how the person comes to trust you. Mm-hmm. And I would say that in a relationship, as a friend with people, if you're suspecting that, you know, your friend, your good friend, maybe has been abused or something, I think the best thing for a friend to do is to just be there and to just be a companion as they heal themselves. As you were saying the other day, the healing comes from within. It isn't so much what you say or the questions you ask or labeling it or anything like that, because that is kind of an organic process that happens within them. And I think the best thing a friend can do is to do what he or she can do, not to do more. Mm-hmm. And sometimes what you need to do is say, you know, Sue, I can't be with you today. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Or whatever. Yes. And because you can't, it's real easy to get overextended in a situation like this. This is really grisly stuff, some of it. And it's hard, as a therapist, it's real hard to hear some of the stories sometimes. And as a regular person, I mean, it is amazing. And those of you who have been in these situations yourself as victims know that some of the stuff is really awful. So I would just say, don't know any more than you can. And the best thing you can do is just care.
Those are good words. I would like to say that it is possible to say something like, is there someone that you can really work through this about? So that to inquire about whether or not the person has a counselor. Right. And to say, it sounds to me like that would be a really good thing for you.
Right.
And let's see if we can find one. Joanne hasn't spoken yet this morning.
I'm way back to the very first question. Very slowly. On getting involved. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe the whole discussion revolves around that in some ways. And I'm not sure that I'm willing to pay the price in some situations to ask the question even about being anorexic or having that experience. Because I don't think I can ask it and stroll down the lane. And that even to ask the question, I have to decide how much I care. And what the price is, if I do care a lot, that the price may be she'll stroll down the lane or he'll stroll down the lane immediately, and it can never be
opened up again, and I'm not a therapist to know what's going to happen mm-hmm. in terms of that price. But the second price is whether I'm really willing to be a part of this healing process then for long term, or if it's the kind of person I can say, here is a therapist, now leave me alone, or not.
Well, you've just given me a thought here, actually. I mean, we've partly been talking about this here as though this person has never disclosed before. And that is an important way to think about this. If it is the first time someone has disclosed, then we may, you may have some long-term things going on there. But I would like to suggest to you that something like reflecting back whenever you hear echoes of violence or abuse in someone's story, that you heard that, and that if they want to talk about it, you might be there. Yes, we might be recycling around the third or the fourth or the sixth time, but that validation that you heard the abusive part of the story, and that you want to mention it, you want to reflect back on it, is a real important part that doesn't necessarily involve you in long-term stuff. Sometimes it's just real important to say, you know, an hour ago I heard you say that about, you know, when you were married and your husband was beating you, and I just wanted to let you know that I heard that. And the person might tell you a chapter, or they might not, or they might just be glad that you were there and you heard it, because the minimization, the trivialization that goes on when we are silent about all those echoes of abuse is not helpful in a healing way. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be spending the next 35 hours. Now, it's a risk, Joanna, because sometimes you might be with someone who just suddenly broke open a chunk right there, and you're the person that gets it. But sometimes people will just say, you know, this is the part of the healing process I'm in now. This is what happened. I'm really glad you spoke about it to me. So it's not always that you're going to land in the middle of a large thing.
But if I do accept the risk, I think the important thing is your last statement about that you have to self-nourish yourself mm-hmm. and someplace else, that you've got to refill your barrel somewhere. And if you do help anybody in any kind of situation, mm-hmm. that there has to be a refilling of your barrel someplace else, yes. not right there,
yes.
and turning the focus.
No, you
don't you think we're missing the whole boat here in a way, because the Bible talks about people having individual gifts. Someone like Joanne, who might be afraid to do this,
good.
She may not have the experience or interest or gift to be involved in healing, you know, whereas someone else would, and they feel a call to do that.
Mm-hmm.
The call is not used very much anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But I really feel that that's very important.
Mm-hmm.
We're all not cut out to do this, like some of us are not cut out to preach or teach or whatever else.
That's good.
Yeah.
Thank you. Did you want to?
I want to add a little bit about this. Sometimes the feeling I get from, for instance, if a friend is going through a situation like that, that somehow I end up going through all her peaks and valleys with her besides my own. And I don't think that's exactly what we meant, do we? We mean that there's going to be more than one person with this person, don't we? And that there are going to be times when I'm going to be helpful.
And I went through
somebody else is going to have to be helpful.
And I went through this whole experience with her without ever hearing any of the gory details.
Mm-hmm.
And I never asked her any pointed questions
mm-hmm.
about, because she had a therapist
mm-hmm.
and she didn't need me for that. She
good.
Just needed me to take over her class when she couldn't do it. She needed
good.
Me to hold her when she cried.
Mm-hmm.
She needed me to say, yeah, go call your therapist and make another appointment if you want to see her today.
Mm-hmm.
And
good.
Yeah, I know you're going to make it through this because you're a strong person.
Good.
You know, we talked about the risk, and I think when it's a friend who comes to you, that's a different story than if it's either an acquaintance or a friend who you hear something, and the risk of bringing it up is that they could take all the negative aggression out on you. You know, in ancient Greece, the bearer of bad news was shot. You know, and if you bring up something that is real terrible for somebody, it could help in the long run, but one of your risks is that they might just hate you for saying it. And this might be something they've kept way back for years and years, and you brought it up, and so then you become the symbol of what brought all this pain out, and you might lose a friend. You know, like I said, if it's a close friend and it comes from them, it's a whole different thing than picking up on something and bringing it up to someone. And sometimes it's worth the risk, but you have to think through, this is a risk, and, you know, do I want to take it?
I hear that that is a real fear that might come up sometimes, that I'll be hurt if I bring up this hurtful thing. But it is my experience that that's never happened to me. That sometimes I might be hurt because of what I might hear, and I might have a hard time separating that from the fact that this other person is now in their pain or revealing their